From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now. President Biden is scheduled to speak later today on Afghanistan, now once again under Taliban control. In recent days, as the U.S. military retreated, Taliban fighters swooped into several key cities before encircling Kabul, the capital. And at the airport there, we're seeing footage on television of human chaos on the tarmac as the U.S. military tries to evacuate Americans and its Afghan allies. The White House is facing criticism for mishandling this exit. And now let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. And Franco, what is the situation now in the White House and what might we hear from the president?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to hear, it's possible that we're going to hear a lot of the same. I mean, so far today, the White House has been defending its strategy. Biden has been so far behind closed doors at Camp David, but he did send out his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, yesterday, and his National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, today on TV to give the administration's point of view. And they have been vigorously defending the approach, arguing that 1 year or 5 years of troops staying in Afghanistan would not have made a difference. That said, it will be very interesting to hear how President Biden responds. This will be the first time that he speaks publicly since the Taliban moved into Kabul. You know, will he remain steadfast in his strategy? Will he back up what his top advisors say? And, you know, as he did also during a statement over the weekend, or perhaps will he acknowledge or even take some responsibility for what's happening?
Well, speaking of response, we are hearing that the fall of Kabul is being compared to the fall of Saigon in 1975, chaos and choppers and airlifts. How's the White House responding to that criticism?
Yeah, it's been very, very difficult criticism, and it is something that the White House has been pushing back on hard. Now, the White House argues, that what is happening now actually confirms their assessment that it was time to leave. While there is some reasonable debate over how long to stay, the most pointed criticism coming at the president from Republicans and some Democrats is that how this was carried out and whether these scary scenes that are unfolding, which you just described, could have been avoided, and what steps could have been taken to mitigate that so we did not have these similar scenes of helicopters landing at the embassy, for example.
Yeah, right. I mean, sure, the Biden administration can make the case that this was the right thing to do. Perhaps the U.S. military wouldn't have made any more inroads if it stayed there. But when we look at the footage today, I mean, it sure looks like something got botched. Is that a pretty hard case to make, given what we're seeing on television?
I think it is a hard case to make. I mean, there were clear intelligence failures. I mean, the administration acknowledges that they did not recognize how fast the troops were going to move in, the Taliban troops I'm referring to. And, you know, just to, you know, add like a couple other points that appeared that they didn't seem to be prepared for is that, you know, not only did American troops leave, but so did the forces of several other NATO nations. And there's also been a lot of discussion about how foreign contractors left, foreign contractors who the Afghan army, you know, depended on. So there was a lot of things. There was kind of a domino effect that, you know, kind of made some of this stuff worse.
This Afghan army, we're seeing it seem to have retreated, disappeared perhaps in a hurry. Does it seem like the White House had a plan, had a contingency for this happening?
Well, I mean, just like I said, it does certainly seem like they underestimated for sure the intelligence. Now, Jake Sullivan was on NBC this morning saying they did have a contingency plan in place. They said that Biden, that the administration underestimated the speed, but at the same time, preparations were made and they had troops in the region. And according to Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, that's how they were able to move these troops in place so quickly. But, you know, as we know, they've been adding thousands of troops almost, first last week, 3,000 last week, then an additional 1,000 over the weekend. Yeah. And then as this week has started, another 1,000. And it seems pretty clear that had they really planned this or expected this, those type of steps would not have been necessary.
Yeah. And Franco, couple seconds left. What is the potential political fallout today for the president?
Well, it's going to be, you know, we will see. I mean, he is already taking some serious political hits about this. You know, I will note that recent polls showed that the American public largely supports Biden here. But, and it is a big but, that was before the crisis that we're seeing on the ground was happening. So a lot could change.
That is NPR's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we've mentioned the terrifying scene at the Kabul airport, thousands of Afghans trying to board U.S. planes as they're moving, the U.S. trying to get people out of the country, and has warned the Taliban to not interfere in that effort. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is at the State Department. Michelle, first, can you add perhaps to that scene at the airport or how it's being viewed at the State Department?
Right. Well, I mean, you talked about these videos that have been shared on social media. There are crowds running alongside U.S. military aircraft, some even trying to cling on to C-17 as it took off. I talked to one U.S. official who just called it awful. The Pentagon spokesman today said that he could not confirm the details of that incident, but he admitted it was hard to watch those videos.
Yeah.
The U.S. had to halt evacuation flights to secure the tarmac. Kirby says there are about 2,500 U.S. troops at the airport now, with several thousand more to come, in a very fluid situation.
Oh, so they had to halt some of the evacuation. But what's the status of U.S. diplomats and other staff? You know, the embassy was evacuated to the airport. So do we know if they got out?
Right. Well, I'm told that the embassy has fewer than 100 personnel at the airport. They're working on these evacuations, too. Hundreds of other embassy personnel have left the country, packing up the U.S. flag, disposing of classified documents and equipment, and basically shuttering what was once one of the largest U.S. embassies in the world.
But that's key. So some of those U.S. Diplomats and embassy workers are at the airport to try to help get others out, to get interpreters and other Afghans who worked with the U.S. military over the past two decades out of the country. We spoke to an Afghan, Michelle, earlier in the program, who said the Taliban is outside his family's home in Kabul. You know, these people are targets. So what does the Taliban takeover of Kabul mean for that effort to get these people out?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that the State Department's focused on, but they're really late in this, you know. They've brought about 2,000 of these Afghans and their family members to Fort Lee in Virginia. And the Pentagon says it's looking for two more places in the U.S. to house them while they go through security and background checks. He says the idea is to have places for another 22,000 Afghans and to look for other countries willing to house them. But that's going to take some time. And there are tens of thousands of Afghans, Robin, as you know, that are seeking to leave.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, there was an emergency UN Security Council meeting today. What'd you hear?
Well, certainly a lot of concern, calls for countries to keep their borders open for Afghan refugees and to stop deportations. I also want to play for you a little bit of tape of Afghanistan's UN ambassador, Ghulam Usakzai. He represents the government that fled Kabul yesterday, and he had one big ask to UN member states.
That the Council and the United Nations will not recognize any administration that achieves power through force or any government that is not inclusive and representative of its diversity.
But soon after he made that appeal, Russia's ambassador said that his country will interact with the Taliban regardless of the evolving situation. The Russians' embassy remains open, and the Taliban has to protect diplomatic missions. The UN also has offices in Afghanistan still that are in areas under UN control. The Secretary General is calling on the Taliban to exercise restraint, saying he's hearing chilling reports out of Kabul, and he's calling on countries again to keep borders open for Afghans trying to flee.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, later today, we expect to hear from President Biden returning from Camp David to the White House to address the country. But how does this work? I mean, who does the State Department call in Kabul? Well, they were in negotiations with the Taliban, so they have contacts. But how does this work?
Right. I mean, the contacts that we're told so far with the Taliban is just about the situation at the airport to make sure that the Taliban doesn't get in the way of these evacuation flights, to make sure that the U.S. can maintain security there. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, the administration keeps saying that they're not, that the Taliban won't have legitimacy if they don't have an inclusive government. But it's not looking likely that that's really going to be the case when you have Russia, China, and others willing to deal with the Taliban.
And, Michelle, we have a little over a half a minute here, but Congressman Seth Moulton is one of those, you know, he's served several tours in Iraq, and he's one of those saying, who cares about visas? Just pile as many people on planes as possible. Is your sense that, though, that those diplomats have to work through a visa system?
Well, they do have that system, but they can do that processing in safer places,
yeah,
in the United States, at U.S. military bases, in third countries. But again, you know, they're talking about maybe ramping up to several thousand people a day getting out, and
yeah,
there are tens of thousands who want to leave.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
Sitting ducks. That's how National Institutes of Health Director Francis Collins is characterizing unvaccinated people in the U.S. as the Delta variant continues to spread. Here he is this weekend on Fox News.
So I will be surprised if we don't cross 200,000 cases a day in the next couple of weeks. And that's heartbreaking, considering we never thought we would be back in that space again. But here we are with Delta variant, which is so contagious, and this heartbreaking situation where 90 million people are still unvaccinated who are sitting ducks for this virus.
Sitting ducks, presumably meaning they will catch it. We know the Delta variant is more infectious. But is it also more lethal? And if it is, for whom? Dr. David Dowdy is an epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Dowdy, the CDC is reporting record hospitalizations among 18 to 29-year-olds, 30 to 39-year-olds, 40 to 49-year-olds, basically all adults under 50. Now, while deaths among young adults from COVID are still uncommon, are death rates going up in these groups?
So yes, Robin, deaths are going up. They're going up more slowly than hospitalizations, but we know that deaths usually lag hospitalizations by 2 to 3 weeks or so. So we're expecting to see deaths climb in the next 2 to 3 weeks as well.
Yeah. And by Saturday, the number of pediatric hospitalizations also hit record highs. This is according to the Department of Health and Human Services. It spiked to over 1,900. What are we seeing in that group when it comes to mortality rates?
I think what we're seeing across the board is that among those who are unvaccinated, the risk of getting sick and of dying is as high as it's ever been, right? Mm-hmm. And so in groups like kids, where vaccines are not yet licensed, we're seeing, as you've said, the highest rates of hospitalizations and deaths that we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic.
Does this mean, then, that the Delta variant, which is more infectious, is also more lethal? Or is it just that the deaths are coming as they would with this number of infections?
Yeah, so I think it's the latter of those, that we don't necessarily know that the Delta variant is more lethal, but what we are seeing is that the rate of transmission among the unvaccinated is as high as it's ever been. Cases are going up. As cases go up, hospitalizations go up, and as hospitalizations go up, the number of deaths goes up as well.
Yeah, and you say vaccinations. I mean, that seems to be the key. We talk about the Delta variant, and you can hear, you know, officials say, well, because of the Delta variant, you know, fill in the blank. But I've also heard health officials, let's say here in New England, say, well, we're not having as much impact from the Delta variant because we have more vaccinations. Is that also underscoring all of this?
Well, Robin, what I would say is that we have attributed a lot to the Delta variant, and it is true that the Delta variant is more transmissible, but it's also true that people are behaving differently now than they were back in, say, February of this year. So we're seeing a lot of the increase in cases attributed to the transmissibility of the Delta variant. But another important part is how people are interacting with each other. And a third important part, as you're saying, is vaccination. And so I think it's really important that we send a message, not that this variant is so transmissible and deadly that there's nothing we can do about it. I think the message is really that by getting more people vaccinated and being a bit more cautious, a bit more respectful of this virus, that we can actually prevent major waves of disease and death from occurring.
And a couple notes. We mentioned kids. Health officials are now saying, stop looking at COVID-19 as an adults-only disease. But we also have spoken of vaccines. There are some breakthroughs. Do we know of any deaths among people who have been vaccinated but picked up, you know, the Delta or any strain of the coronavirus?
So, yes, there have been deaths among the vaccinated. And since most cases of COVID-19 are due to the Delta variant these days in the United States, we would suspect that those are deaths among people who've been infected with the Delta variant. It is important for people to recognize, though, that vaccines are effective against getting this disease, even more effective against getting serious disease, and even more effective against getting disease that's so serious that you would die from it, right? So it has happened. It can happen. It can happen particularly in instances where people have been very intensely exposed and or have underlying medical conditions that put them at greater risk, right? And these are people we really should be trying to protect, but still a very rare occurrence.
Dr. David Dowdy, epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Dowdy, it sounds like you're saying the same thing we've been hearing all along, to not only get vaccinated, but even if vaccinated, wear a mask in public, especially if you might be exposed to people who are not vaccinated.
I think that's right. I think it's important for people to realize that this current wave will not last forever. But while cases are still going up, I think it's really important to be a little bit more cautious in the way we live our lives.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, to Haiti now, where over 1,200 people are dead after that 7.2 earthquake struck the southern part of the country Saturday morning. Rebar and concrete flattened, homes demolished, thousands more injured, and then there's the unknown number of people missing, trapped under the rubble. The death toll is expected to rise. NPR correspondent Jason Bovian is in Haiti on his way west from Port-au-Prince to the area most affected. Jason, what are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, even we've actually just passed by where the epicenter was, and there's buildings just completely flattened in some of these small villages. You know, the top stories have pancaked onto the stories below them. There's a lot of concrete debris all around these smashed buildings, and even on the road as you're driving in, there's landslides. There's extra debris out on the roads. This area was really hard hit.
Well, it's chilling because this earthquake was stronger than the one in 2010 that killed almost 220,000 people. And, you know, are you seeing rescue efforts? What's your sense of enough rescuers and resources?
Well, you know, certainly we're hearing from people in Port-au-Prince that all of that is underway, but you get out here and people are saying they haven't seen any government officials come to talk to them. They haven't seen any aid arrive yet. People are telling us, in just the very first town that we stopped in, we need help. And it was clear that they did. You know, I talked to this one guy whose four-month-old son was killed when a piece of concrete fell on him. And he really would like to get some assistance removing the top story of that building, which is now just dangling there. But they say they haven't seen anyone come through who's offering them assistance. So frustration is rising as well amongst people who are waiting for assistance. And the other big issue is that a lot of people are sleeping outside. You've got mattresses sitting on top of like piles of crumbled cinder blocks because people don't want to go back inside because they're so terrified that the shaking is going to come back.
Yeah. Well, we understand that aid groups were finding it difficult to get to this area even before the earthquake because of how tightly gangs were controlling Haiti and the roads there. So thank you for your reporting, but what is your sense of the gangs?
Well, so we just drove that road, which up until just recently was very much a no-go zone for lots of people, including aid agencies, businesses, that they couldn't get trucks through there. And we drove through this one section in Marc des Sens, and it was striking. The street is just completely deserted. The neighborhoods around it, there's no people in them. All of the businesses are shut down. There's garbage piled all over the place and smashed cars that have just been abandoned there. And in Haiti, it's very unusual to see buildings in the town and everything with no one in it. And that is the area that the gang controls right now. And supposedly there's a truce or something going on that the gangs are not attacking vehicles coming through there right now. But you can see how frightening it is just because of how quiet it is as you're moving through what normally would be a bustling Haitian market.
Yeah. Well, in the minute and a half we have, there's two other forces here. The July assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse. One wonders what shape the government is in for a crisis like this. And then Tropical Storm Grace, expected to pass nearby Haiti today. So address both those concerns.
Yeah, certainly the political instability is one concern. Prime Minister Ariel Henry, however, is really trying to step up into the role as the leader of the country. He's been out here. He's been touring. He's been visiting patients who are waiting outside hospitals to get treatment. He definitely is attempting to step up and show that there is not a leadership vacuum at the very top. When it comes to Tropical Storm Grace, people here are very concerned about that. As I mentioned earlier, people have been sleeping outside because they don't trust going back inside these buildings. A lot of these buildings have cracks in them. They've got sometimes upper stories that are still like dangling from some rebar, and people are now worried that they're going to get soaking wet. It really looks like that storm is on track to hit this area quite hard.
Yeah.
So this is one more thing that's sort of being piled on the people in this part of Haiti, you know, people who have suffered so much up until now.
That's NPR correspondent Jason Beaubien, live on his phone from Haiti, on the trail of that earthquake. Jason, best to you and your crew there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
As we monitor Afghanistan, we are hearing initial reaction from the Afghan diaspora. France is home to one of the largest Afghan communities, and NPR's Eleanor Beardsley hears from two Afghan women in Paris.
Zora Yari looks like a Parisian in her flouncy summer skirt and on-the-go short feathered haircut. She received asylum in 2017. Today, she's earning a university degree in international humanitarian action. Yari takes me inside the French Refugee Association, where she's doing a six-month internship. She says she loves being in Paris with all its opportunities, but it's torture to watch what's happening in her homeland, where her mother, three brothers, and two sisters remain.
I cry the whole day. I can't control myself. My body is in France, but my whole mentality is all in Afghanistan.
Yari, who is 29, remembers the Taliban from when she was a young girl before they were ousted by the U.S. invasion in 2001. But they regained control of some parts of the country. She recalls passing through Taliban checkpoints in her early 20s.
The Taliban stopped our cars for checking if people were working with government or the foreign associations. They check always, and they find them, they kidnap them, and it was too hard. I can't breathe.
Yari says this is the second Taliban wave to crash over her family. The group kidnapped her father in 2000. The family never saw him again. She says her mother managed the family's land holdings and kept everyone together. Even though her mother wasn't educated, she insisted her daughters go to school.
My mother said that you have to study and you have to work for Afghanistan.
Bonjour, je suis Shekiba Hashemi.
Shekiba Hashemi, another Afghan in France, heads an NGO that runs a network of girls' schools across Afghanistan. She came to France in 1984 at the age of 11 and returned to Afghanistan in 2001 to become the first woman to serve in the first freely elected Afghan government. In the last few weeks, Hashemi has been frantically closing schools to keep teachers and directors from being kidnapped and killed. She says the U.S. and the Europeans have abandoned Afghanistan.
After the World Trade Towers, the world woke up that Afghanistan was the source of evil. 20 years later, we're leaving, but this time we're giving them the keys.
Hashemi says what's happening is not just an Afghan problem. International terrorists are flocking there, she says, and plan to build a new country. Terroristan, she calls it, because it will be a laboratory exporting terrorism to the entire world. Zora Yari, the university student, says she's most worried about her nieces back in Kabul. It's well known that Taliban fighters take young girls to be their brides. She shows me her 14-year-old niece dancing on a TikTok video, wearing makeup and stylish clothing, just like any teenage girl in the West. People on the outside might not realize it, says Yari, but the last 20 years were a golden time for Afghans.
We studied, we did in our school, especially the young people. Right now, they have hope. They want to work in Afghanistan.
Now that seems over. Yari understands the U.S. couldn't stay forever, but she says the Americans are leaving at the wrong time and in the wrong way. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
And let's take a break from the dispiriting news, shall we, with someone who tends to lift our spirits. Jennifer Hudson first made America sit up straight when she was a finalist on the 2004 season of American Idol. She also starred as Effie in the 2006 film of the musical Dreamgirls. Years earlier, Jennifer Holliday starred in the stage version and pretty much blew the doors off with her version of this showstopper. So Jennifer Hudson decided to take off the roof. She won an Oscar for that performance. Might there be another in her future? Reviewers are singing Jennifer Hudson's praises in the role of her idol, Aretha Franklin, as she moves from obedient daughter and wife singing jazz standards to Black Panther-supporting music visionary who shaped a singular sound in popular music in the new film Respect. Gee, how'd they ever come up with that title? What you want, baby, I got what you need. Jennifer Hudson singing one of Aretha Franklin's signature songs, handpicked by Franklin herself before she died on this day, August 16th, 2018, to play the part. Again, the film is Respect, and Jennifer Hudson is here. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me. Such an amazing introduction. Thank you for that.
Well, it's such an experience. A lot comes with you, Jennifer Hudson. Let's start with, we read that Aretha Franklin worked for almost 2 decades to try to bring her story to the screen, and then she picks you to play her. When you picked yourself up off the floor, what did you think?
You know what? I'm still picking myself up off the floor, okay? It's something, you know, I don't take lightly, and it's so, the magnitude of it is so huge, I have to take it in doses. Like, even when we started to film, I was like, is this really happening now? You know, so it's so surreal. And it was also a dream of mine to play her. Yeah. So, yeah.
And executive producer as well. What does that mean?
Wow. I'm still learning what it means, but I felt as though I'm glad because it was such a personal project and I felt like it allowed me to be that much more involved.
Well, I wondered if it was also homage to her, because as we see in the film, we're reminded, you know, we saw it in the terrific documentary on her, what a hard time she had once she became a singer and had a record label, what a hard time she had getting across what she wanted to be.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've taken that as a lesson from the film, you know, like you want to take ownership of your own journey and destiny and your voice as well. And that's what this has inspired me to want to do even more. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a little. In the film, we get to see how Aretha took charge. In one really thrilling scene, she sits at the piano and she coaches the legendary Muscle Shoals musicians in Alabama, directing them as they work out a song. We also see Aretha, or Ree as her family calls her, at home at the piano with her sisters, building what would become Respect.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
One more time.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Go a third below, Carolyn.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Her legacy, I mean, I think she already know that. We all know that. Will always live on, and we will always celebrate her. And that's the most beautiful part about this, to see her legacy being celebrated, because she gave us so much in her life.
Well, but also to show how much she was the creator of it.
Exactly. And that part, you know, that's the thing, it's no artist design like her. It's beneath her to call her an artist. She was a composer. She was music. So I think that's the beauty in the film as well, where people get to see her musicianship, her artistry, her as a vocalist, and her as the beautiful human being that she was.
Let's go back to the influence she was on you before you even dreamt you'd play her. You sang her in that audition for American Idol. Here's Share Your Love With Me. This is in 2004. Let's listen.
It's an evil wind that blows no good, yeah, yeah. It's a sad heart that won't love like I know it should.
Oh, can I just say, do I remember you didn't win?
No, seventh place. Proud of it.
It's such a great message to everyone, whoever tries out for anything. Somehow you didn't win with that. But what was that? Were you trying to bring her with? What is Aretha Franklin to you when it comes to singing?
Wow. I mean, she's like the ultimate everything when it comes to music, you know? And now we know through the film, you know, she's also that much more impactful in her life. But for me, like, I grew up in a church singing, and it's every church girl, every church singer's dream to want to be like Aretha Franklin, you know, and then a singer at that. And so when I was going for my American Idol audition, I'm like, well, if I'm going to sing in a talent show, honey, I need to have the best song. And who better to go to than, you know, Aretha Franklin, pick her song for my audition.
But even then and even now, you're not mimicking her. Your voices are different. I don't know how to describe it. Yours feels like it has a rounder sound, and hers had that great, great kind of, I don't know what I'm saying here, but.
No, I understand what you're saying.
They're different. They're different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Well, let's listen. First you, then Aretha Franklin, singing Think. And you talk about what she was in her life, more than a singer. She was practically raised by Martin Luther King. She was drawn towards Angela Davis, and she was a survivor. Grew up the daughter of a preacher man. Her mother was a beautiful singer. They had a contentious divorce. She lost her mother when Aretha was 10. Her father became very controlling. She was preyed upon by an older family friend. Gave birth at 12.
Yes.
That was heartbreaking.
Yes. Yes. To see the triumphs that she, you know, endured in her life, and then to see her prevail and still overcome them, it can't help but to be inspiring. And I think that's the power of the film. You know, everyone always tend to think that when it comes to legends and icons, that is simple and easy for them. But under that is a life and a story. And, you know, and while we were filming, I said, I know we all have a respect for Ms. Aretha Franklin, but by the time you get done with the film, I would love for people to have a newfound respect for her. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, her first husband, he was abusive. We see that. There was a lot of abuse. And this is a tender topic. There's a lot of abuse in this film. There's a lot of tragedy. You've seen tragedy in your life. I know that that's not something that you want to talk about, but what's your sense of what one draws upon?
You know, well, we all have tragedies and triumphs in our lives, you know, whether, you know, they can differ, but the thing is, everyone has a life and everyone has things to get through. And I look at her story and mine as well as a testimony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and we're seeing Jennifer Hudson up there on the screen as well. Where do you go from here?
You know what? I always say only God can, you know, can say that and decide. So he brought me this far. So we will have to see. And I'm just grateful to be able to be here today for her to entrust me with this. Yes.
Jennifer Hudson, who channels Aretha Franklin in the new film Respect. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are strong.
Jennifer Hudson singing Here I Am, Singing My Way Home, which she co-wrote with Carole King, who wrote Natural Woman. It's on the film's soundtrack, out now.
By now, you may have seen footage of chaos at the Kabul airport. Desperation and fear from Afghans swarming U.S. planes in the tarmac, trying to escape as the Taliban retake control. There are reports of people falling to their deaths, clinging to departing jets. This morning, the Deputy National Security Advisor, John Finer, said this to NPR.
We will continue to be working on securing the airport and maintaining these flights for as long as that can be done safely and securely.
The chaos at the airport is exactly what many advocates hoped to avoid, as they called for an orderly evacuation. One of those advocates is Krish Omer Vignaraja. She's president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And Krish, what do you hear now about the U.S.-Afghan allies in Kabul trying to get out?
Yeah, obviously the security situation is dire. We have heard uncorroborated reports of the Taliban going door-to-door in Kabul in search of those who serve the U.S. mission. We are told that, many of the Afghans that we've worked with, their family members, have fled to the airport in Kabul. There's a palpable sense of fear and anxiety among them. You can see that in the harrowing footage of children and families at the airport running with nothing but what they can carry as gunfire rattles off in the distance. And we at LIRS were inundated with cries for help. SIVs stuck in provinces already overtaken by the Taliban, who are hiding in their houses. Others in Kabul, not sure whether to go to the airport or shelter in place.
Do you know whether there are planes that are still leaving? And if they are, who's likely to get on?
Yeah, so throughout the night, as we understood it, military and civilian flights were halted. We are now hearing about the resumption or plans for military flights. But it does seem quite ad hoc. There had been preparations for more organized evacuation of SIVs. They would have arrived through Dulles to Fort Lee this week.
And forgive me, what does SIV stand for the rest of us?
It's special immigrant visas. So these are for the interpreters, translators, drivers, engineers, security guards who worked alongside U.S. troops.
And as far as these individuals who have been presumably waiting in line to get these visas, what's happening now to this visa process, given what we're seeing happening in real time in Kabul?
Yeah. So the special immigrant visa applicants who faithfully served alongside U.S. troops and the embassy, they're in grave danger. For many of them, being left behind may amount to a death sentence, not just for them, but for their families as well. But this is where we still have time to act. And with the U.S. military's growing presence, as Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer mentioned, will depend on the U.S. military presence. But I have the utmost confidence that we can still save the lives of our allies. But this is where the U.S. needs to act with the urgency required, because we've only seen a small fraction of these individuals evacuated to safety here in the U.S.
And what do those numbers look like? You said small fraction.
Yeah, so we've had about 1,200 SIVs and their family members relocated to the U.S. thus far, but that's against a backdrop of upwards of 80,000 allies and their family members who are still stuck in Afghanistan. And that doesn't even count the women's rights activists, journalists, academics, NGO workers, other civil society leaders who are obviously, in Afghanistan still and whose lives are in jeopardy.
So the Biden administration, as you mentioned, is saying it has intentions to help these Afghans who have been on the American side. And yet here we are today, as you look at this crisis unfold on the screen, on TV, could this have been avoided?
Yeah, candidly, it could have, and it should have been. We've been advocating for a full-scale evacuation of these allies and their families for months now, and it was clear to anyone with a passing familiarity of the bureaucratic maze that is the State Department's special immigrant visa processing that it was not going to be agile enough to respond with the urgency needed. So we've been screaming from the rooftops for months that we needed to get these allies to Guam or other U.S. territory. And unfortunately, it seemed that the administration was considering whether they could outsource this moral and military obligation to third countries. And so we find ourselves where we are now.
Krish, you mentioned the U.S. bureaucracy and the government here. In your view, what is the main thing that's gone wrong?
It was the administration relying on what was clearly a bureaucratic process instead of acting with the urgency required of a war zone. These individuals should have been evacuated to U.S. territory, as we've done in all three historical examples, whether it was the Vietnamese, Kosovo, or Iraq. Instead, the answer from the State Department and the White House was we need to rely on the visa processing, and clearly that failed. And as a result, we have allies who are in harm's way as the Taliban takes control of the country.
Mm. All right. Krish Omara Vignaraja. She's president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.